Shabbat Shalom and welcome to Kehilat Tenuva, The Harvest, a Messianic Charismatic Congregation in Thornton, Colorado. You're listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. Our goal is to provide, for free, the message of the Torah from a Messianic Judaic perspective. Here's Pastor Mark.
Shabbat Shalom. My message today is how to persevere in faithfulness. We know being faithful to the covenant is no easy task. We have a sin nature that pulls at us. We have a tempter. We have the world around us. So staying faithful to the covenant is no easy task. There's a lot of pushback from the world that we live in. And so I want to talk about some keys to persevering in faithfulness. The world is full of paganism. It's all around us. It's embedded in every culture around the world, and no one is exempt, no one, from its seductions. Yet God calls his people, us, those who believe in him and his son, the Mashiach, he calls his people to come out of it and into the true worship of him, the Most High God. So how do we free ourselves from the paganism all around us? And more importantly, how do we persevere in faithfulness to God and his ways while living in the midst of a world inundated with paganism? So yes, paganism is everywhere. I want to pick up a reading in Genesis where God disinherits mankind due to their love affair with rebellion. This is the third of three falls, three major falls of humanity. This is the third one, and it's at this one that God says, you know what? I'm going to disinherit you. Genesis chapter 11, 9 through 10. This is the story of Babel. I'm jumping into the middle of it, actually, the end of the story. It says, therefore, its name was called Babel because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Because they would not fulfill his mandate after the flood, right? They came together, they're going to build a city, make a name for themselves, instead of obeying the Lord God in taking and scattering throughout the world and bringing Eden, so to speak, to the world. Therefore, God says, that's it, I'm done. I'm going to confuse your languages, and then I'm going to scatter you to the ends of the earth. Now, God tells his people, much later, Israel, he says, worship me and me alone. Do not worship me through other things, through creatures, through beings. Worship me and me alone. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 15 through 20 says this. So watch yourselves carefully. He's speaking to his covenant people. So watch yourselves carefully. Take care. Think through what you're doing. Don't be naive and unsuspecting. But watch yourselves carefully, since you did not see any form on the day the Lord spoke to you at Oreb from the midst of the fire, so that you do not act corruptly and make a graven image for yourselves in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that is on the earth, the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the sky, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, the likeness of any fish that is in the water below the earth. He says, don't do that. Don't make images and use those images as reflections of my attributes, as a pedestal to worship me. That's what the pagans do. Don't do that. Israel is to worship God alone, not through that which is created. Worshiping things through that which is created, that is what paganism is all about. That's how pagans worship. Pagans worship the created, making God in their own image. And paganism is the worship of the created realm and its powers. So all the other nations, when he scatters them at Babel, when he moves them out and disinherits them, they're actually handed over to fallen gods. Because they're rebellious, and this is the third major rebellion, and they're trying to penetrate the heavens, and they're preoccupied with the paganism and the powers of the world, this supernatural and natural world that's overlapping and intersecting, God says, okay, I'm going to hand you over. to those fallen ones. Let's read this, Deuteronomy chapter 4, 19. He says to his people, and I'll talk more in a minute about the fallen sons of God, but to his people, he says, beware not to lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars and all the hosts of heaven and be drawn away and worship them and serve them, those which the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven. Isn't that interesting? He says, watch out for this host of heaven, these beings, these fallen ones. You'll be drawn away to worship and serve them. They're not for you. I gave them to the nations that I scattered. They're appointed to the ones that have this love affair with a rebellion, right? The fallen sons of God are part of the host of heaven, and they're given over to the rebellious nations to be worshiped, to be misled, and to be brought into the bondage of paganism. In short, rebellious people deserve rebellious gods to rule over them and lead them, but not for Israel. Let me read this. Let me go on. It's the next verse, Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 20. But the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace from Egypt to be a people for his own possession as today. God says, I'm going to scatter the nations and I'm going to start over. And he took from Abraham and Sarah and he made a nation, Israel. And he says, you're going to be my allotment, my inheritance. He says to Israel, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall worship him and him alone. The nations, again, are given over to the fallen Elohim, the fallen gods, small g, the fallen gods, to rule over them as God takes Israel for himself. Now, ultimately, through Israel, all the nations are going to be invited back into a saving, restorative relationship with God. And those who respond to this gracious invitation will be saved. This whole thing comes right down through Abraham and Sarah. All of biblical, you know, soteriology, ecclesiology, this whole realm of the plan of redemption comes down through one nation, Israel, and through Israel back to all the nations. Israel's central to the scriptures, both the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, the sons of God that we read about are correlated to the borders of the nations. Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 7 through 8. Moses says to his people here, remember the days of old. I want you to consider days gone by. And he's going to refer back to the Tower of Babel here. He says, consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, what did God give to them? Fallen gods and geography, territory. And those fallen gods had authority in those geographical regions over those people groups. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. Now, some of your translations will say sons of Israel. The problem is Israel's not on the map at the Tower of Babel. They won't come into view for many, many years. Yeah, it's actually a reference to the sons of God, not sons of Israel. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, the find here that they did, 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, when they found Qumran and all the texts, verify that the correct translation is the translation that says sons of God, not sons of Israel, because that's what the context was all about. According to the number of the sons of God, this is a direct reference to Genesis chapter 6. When the sons of God left their domain and came down and cohabitated with the daughters of men. Now let me go to Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verse 9. But the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted heritage. God takes Israel for himself and he gives the nations over to the fallen Elohim. and they're scattered, they're given borders, they become people groups, and they have these divine beings that rule over them. This is so fascinating. When you think of principalities and powers and authorities in the context of geographical regions, that's Paul in Ephesians chapter 6. He's drawing off of this Deuteronomy 32 paradigm, this world view of the world that we live in and what took place at Babel. It's fascinating in every sense. Let's take a look at how these fallen Elohim, these know-it-alls, are doing in their reign over the various nations. Isn't that true? Isn't it true? People tend to rebel against authorities when they think they know more than their authorities. When you think you know more than your parents, your boss, whatever, that's when you tend to exert yourself, right? And break away and be your own kind of authority. So let's see how they're doing. Let's check up on them. Psalms chapter 82, verses 1 through 2. It says here, God has taken his place in the divine council. The word divine here is a reference to the Elohim. Okay? God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, small g, he holds judgment. How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Selah. It's where you stop. The author wants you to think about this. God takes his place in his own divine council. God has a divine council long before he created us. He created other divine beings and angels before he created the natural realm. And they served as a council to him. He says, God takes his place in the divine council in the midst of the Elohim, the gods. He holds judgment. How long, he says, will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? In other words, you get an F. You're not doing too well. You're corrupt and you're abusive. Goes on to say, give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. Verse 6. I said, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men, you shall die and fall like any prince. It's a reference to these gods. You know, the whole issue of Elohim and what Elohim means in the Hebrew, the central core aspect of this concept of the Elohim, gods with a small g, is immortality. They're immortals. These beings are immortal beings. It makes no sense to try to say, well, he's talking about the judges in Israel. He's not. He says, nevertheless, like men, you shall die. Like men, like mortals. You immortal Elohim, you immortals are going to die like mortals. You who are immortal, I'm going to strip you of your immortality, and you're going to die like a mortal. Reference Ephesians 6 again and again and again, and you'll see the backdrop of Ephesians 6 and what our warfare is all about. And then it goes on to finish with this. The psalmist cries out, arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit the nations. The idea that in the plan of redemption, God is going to reclaim the nations. In the end, he's going to invite them back under his rule and his domain. And he's going to do that through Israel. Israel, again, is central in the plan of redemption. Jesus was a Jew. He's the consummate Israelite. Came to save his people first and then the nations. So in summary so far, mankind as a whole rebels a third time. God disinherits them. He assigns them languages, borders, and fallen ones to rule over them. They will be seduced and worship the fallen ones according to the ways of the fallen ones. This is the very definition of paganism. God will start over in his plan to redeem his creation. He's going to raise up one man and one woman, Abraham and Sarah. And from them, he's going to raise up a nation. It's going to become Israel, his chosen people, his allotment. They are called to worship him and him alone, in spirit and in truth. they're going to be a light for all the other nations. Those that love darkness, again, are handed over to the false gods and enslaved by paganism. Those that love God are freed from the darkness of paganism and brought into the light of God and His ways. This is the ongoing battle over creation in terms of who is going to rule over it. Okay, so let's talk about pagan forms of worship versus true forms of worship. John 8, 23 through 24, we all know the passage. It's a very popular passage. Jesus, speaking to the woman at the well, says to her concerning worship issues, because she raised some issues related to worship. He says, an hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers, isn't that interesting? When the true worshipers, that tells us there are false worshipers. There are false worship systems. There are false gods. The time is coming. And now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit from their hearts and truth according to His ways. For such people, the Father seeks to be His worshipers. God is seeking worshipers. And these are the ones that He's seeking for, those who will worship Him in spirit and in truth. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must, it's not optional. Those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth. What does that mean, right? It means simply that true worshipers have God and His ways in their heart of hearts. Deuteronomy 12, 29 through 30. These are the laws related to worship. When the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations whom you go in to dispossess, speaking to Israel, and you dispossess them and dwell in their land, take care that you be not ensnared to follow them after they have been destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire about their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods that I also may do the same? Paganism is powerful, and it's beautiful, and it's seductive. That's why he says, take care. Don't play with that. Don't look into that. It's inviting. It's seductive. It'll get a hold of you. Be careful. It's a snare. It's a trap. How do you catch animals with traps in the wild? Yeah, you put bait on that trap. It's covered. The animal doesn't see the trap. It sees the bait. It's lured in, and then it is caught and held against this well. Bad things are going to happen to that creature. God says, you know what? You don't want to play with this stuff because it'll suck you in. It'll get a hold of you and you'll get enslaved by it. Don't flirt with this stuff. These gods are really gods. They're fallen Elohim. They're powerful. They're seductive. They know what they're doing. They have an agenda to pull us away from the living God. Do not take them for granted. Verse 31. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. Isn't that interesting? For every abominable thing the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. They even burned their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. Now look at this phrase. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. So two things here. Number one, don't look into it. Don't play with it. You'll get sucked into it. You know, this idea that, you know, well, all gods lead to God, like all roads lead to Rome, you know, worship is worship. No, that's not true. You need to stay away from it. God says, don't do that. Don't worship them. And he says, and don't look at the ways they worship their gods and then worship me in that way. Put that verse back up, please. Slide 43. You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. In what way? In the way they worship their gods. These are also called the laws of idolatry, by the way. Your first three commandments are all about idolatry. Most of us don't understand what the backdrop of those laws are, what the context of those laws are. Most people don't even understand what idolatry is. Idolatry is when you worship God in a way that's unacceptable to Him, in the way that the pagans worship their gods. How you worship is important too. Not just who you worship, how you worship. This is important to God. He says, do not repackage pagan modalities of worship and then bring that into my house and offer it up to me. Don't do that. Verse 32, everything that I command you, you shall be careful to do. What's the context? How to worship. The context is how to worship. So, what you know, he's saying, everything I command you in the context of worship, you shall be careful. Take note of that. Pay attention. Don't be casual in how you approach me. Be careful in how you approach me. I'm the living God. You shall not add to it nor take away from it. You don't get to add to how you worship me or take away from how to worship me. Now, the enemy, he had a brilliant strategy, absolutely brilliant strategy to capture our hearts. You know what that's called? Syncretism. Syncretism. Let me give you a definition. Syncretism is this. It's the reconciliation or fusion of differing systems of belief, as in philosophy or religion. Can we put that up, please? Reconciliation or fusion of differing systems of belief, as in philosophy or religion. Think about this. You take something that's opposed to something else, and then you bring it together and fuse it, turning it into one, verses two. Here's the lie. Worship is worship. It may be different in form, but in the end, it's all worship. Actually, that's a lie. Another one is this. It's not important how you worship, but that you worship. That's a lie too. It's a half-truth. It's a truth mixed with a lie. Fusing truths with lies is a powerful strategy to ensnare the unsuspecting. Think of the trap again. What is the trap? Two opposing things, right? Some delicious food, right? With what? Something that's going to kill you, take your life. So they use the bait to cover the trap in order to catch the prey. In syncretism, the truth is used as the lure to pull people in, and the hook is the lie that pulls you into bondage. So the enemy is going to give a certain amount of truth mixed with some lies, and that's how he's going to pull you into the worship of the created or into pagan forms of worship, knowing that that's going to, in some ways, begin to undermine your relationship with the living God. So in the end, if one is not careful to obey God's word, paganism will seduce them to worship God in ways that he said, don't worship me. As a result, people get ensnared by the beauty of paganism and then held within its dark grasp. It will keep us from being a true worshiper of the Father. It's not a salvation issue. It's still very important. It's not a salvation issue. But to God, this is a big deal. Let me give you some examples of syncretism. First one, Christmas. Christmas fuses the virgin birth of Messiah with the birth of Mithra. Has anyone heard of Mithra? Okay, so in Rome, Rome worshipped the sun as the chief astral deity in the skies. Later in the Roman Empire, as it moves into the first, second, third century, the sun cults become very powerful, and the issue of the sun being the chief astral god becomes premier in Rome. And so there's a few sun cults, of course, and the people are caught up into this. And the sun, of course, the invincible sun, this god in the sky, incarnates and becomes a human being. There's an incarnation of the sun. Guess who that is? Mithra. Mithra is the incarnation of the sun. And guess when he was born? December 25th. So what the enemy does is he takes some truths about Jesus and his birth. He mixes in some lies about the false Messiah and his birth. He's going to put that together and fuse it together. And this is exactly what God's saying. Don't do this. Don't do it. So let's look at the virgin birth. Here's the truth. The Messiah was born. He was born of a virgin. Just as Isaiah prophesied, it came to pass. Jesus, born of Miriam, the virgin. The Messiah, who was with God in the beginning and was one with God, took on human flesh and blood in the incarnation. Concerning Jesus the Messiah, John said, "The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us." Now, to the Jewish ear, that just does all kinds of things, okay? "The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. We looked upon his glory, the glory of the one and only from the Father, full of grace and truth." This is John's core passage about the birth of Jesus. Early Christian scholarship, as well as contemporary Christian scholarship, has noted that John uses the central symbol and theology of the fall festival of Sukkot, Leviticus 23, the fall festival of tabernacles, as being the very context for understanding the birth of Jesus. So remember that festival, Leviticus 23? God says, "I want you all to live in booths for 8 days. I want you to live in booths, and I want you to be reminded through those booths that I was with you in the wilderness, that my promise to dwell among you was fulfilled or initially fulfilled in that era, and that the promise of me drawing closer and closer and coming in to you, to dwell with you, will be fulfilled." It was a promise that pointed forward to the ultimate fulfillment of the meaning of tabernacles. I will dwell among my people. John says, Jesus in his birth tabernacled with us. He came to dwell with us in a human tent, a human tabernacle. John connects his birth theologically, irrefutably, with the fall festival of tabernacles. And early Christian scholarship picks this up. They point out that the birth of Jesus is, in fact, the fulfillment of the mystery and meaning of the fall festival of tabernacles. Jesus' birth was and remains embedded and entrenched in the fall festival of Sukkot. Decorating a sukkah is one of the biblical ways of celebrating when God became a human and tabernacled among us. Think about that. What's Hanukkah? The festival of light, the festival of revelation. Are you getting some revelation here? That God becomes one of us? He pitches a human tabernacle? And we then decorate these sukkahs every year to celebrate his presence among us as being fulfilled in Yeshua. What a beautiful celebration of his birth. Decorating the very symbol of his incarnation. He is the light of the world. Here's the lie. Those are the truths. Here's the lies. Ready? Jesus was born on December 25th. That's not true. That is not true. Mithra, the false Messiah, who is the incarnation of the invincible Son, was born on December 25th. That's who was born on December 25th. And long before Christians officially adopted December 25th to be the date of Jesus' birth, Roman pagans had been worshiping and celebrating their sun god's birth on December 25th. Decades and decades and decades later, Christians then choose that date. Let me read a quote from Professor Manfred Claus in his monumental work, A Roman Cult of Mithras, The God and His Mysteries. "Light comes from the firmament. Mithras is the god of light, the new light which births forth each morning from the vault of heaven behind the mountains and whose birthday is celebrated on the 25th of December. A late antique Syriac commentator describes this festival and correctly observes that it later developed into the birthday of Christ." Here's the quote. "It was, in fact, customary among the pagans to celebrate the festival of the Son's birthday on the 25th of December and to light bonfires in honor of the day. They even used to invite the Christian population to these rites. But when the teachers of the church realized that Christians were allowing themselves to take part, they decided to observe the feast of the true birth, speaking of Messiah, they decided to observe the feast of the true birth on that same day. End quote. People can argue all they want. The history is super clear. And the arguments, even though they get more and more refined every year, man, just looking at the data, it's pretty easy to figure out what was going on. The enemy is a liar, and he's crafty. He's skilled. So let's talk about the symbols of December 25th. Here's the symbols. Now think through this. When you think of the biblical symbol of the birth of Christ being the sukkah, going all the way back to the days of Moses, this is amazing. The symbol of December 25th is a decorated fir tree instead of a sukkah. It's a decorated fir tree. And this leads, of course, to the paganism of the ancient world. The main symbols of Mithra's birth are in order. Number one, the main symbols, a stone monument, because a number of the passages in Mithraism posit the idea that Mithra came forth from a great stone, a great rock. He's the rock god, rock of ages in paganism, okay? Then the next main symbol, or the next symbol after the main symbol of the stone monument, is a tree, a tree. Mithra was born from a tree, so there's a number of archaeological finds depicting Mithra coming out of a tree. And then finally, a few instances in which they depict Mithra, the sun god incarnate, coming out of a cosmic egg. We'll get down to that in a moment, right? Fascinating passage in Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 9. God says concerning Israel, because of the lightness of her harlotry, she polluted the land and committed adultery with stones and trees. I want you to think through this a little bit. Do you think this idea of stones and trees come into civilization during the period of the Romans? This whole issue of worshiping stones and trees, it goes all the way back to the earliest parts of our civilization. They just show up in different ways with different gods and all of the paganism that permeates this world. God says, I'm going to divorce you, Israel. I'm going to divorce you. Put that back up, please. Slide 53. I'm going to divorce you. Why? Because of the lightness of her harlotry, she polluted the land and committed adultery with stones and trees. Worshipping God via stone monuments and trees constituted pagan idolatry. This is what God characterized as spiritual adultery. Israel was seduced and pulled into pagan forms of worship. But the big question is, what about Christianity? Yeah, we always talk about Israel falling away, apostasy, idolatry, adultery. Well, what about Christianity? Did she fall for similar forms of paganism? Let's go to our first slide. Okay, this is St. Peter's Square, the Basilica in Rome. So this is the center of Christianity. It represents the largest flow of Christianity. All other rivers that flow from her find their roots in her. The Protestants are the daughters of the Roman Catholic Church. I don't say that in a derogatory way, but in a historical way. So this whole issue of the center and core of Christianity and their celebration of what? What two things are out here in the square? The decorated tree of December 25th that's tied into the pagan ways that pagans worship their gods. And then next to it is what? An Egyptian obelisk. These are stone monuments that were involved in sun worship back in Egypt. What are we doing putting up a stone monument with the tree? What are we doing? What is that all about? Now, if you notice, what's on the stone monument? Yes. You know what that's depicting? The triumph of Christianity over paganism. You know why that's a problem? Because most Christians don't read the Old Testament. They don't read where God says, look, when you come into the land and I bless you, tear down all the idols, remove them, clean out the land. Don't take them and then put them up for whatever reason. You're supposed to get rid of them. So anyway, we put them up, right? Let's go to our next slide. This is the national Christmas tree. Guess where? Washington, D.C., the capital of the USA. Now, I think it's okay to put it there because that happens to be the District of Columbia. I'm just saying. But then again, what are we doing as a nation when we as a nation are involved in this? This is what I said earlier, that the paganism is all around us. It's even in us. Now, the Christmas tree in the White House, this is the one outside the White House, but the one that they put inside the White House, it's amazing what they do with that every year. It's just shocking. Back in 2009, they decided, I don't track this, but in 2009, what they did was something astonishing. They decided to get ornaments on the tree and put celebrities on those ornaments on the tree in the White House. Putting people who represented lifestyles and values that are abhorrent and repulsive to the Lord God. Stephen Polito, he made it onto the tree in 2009. He's the one that actually calls himself Head of Lettuce and claims on his website that he is New York City's premier drag queen. Now, drag queen is just PC for male transvestite. So he was one of those that were celebrated on the tree back in 2009. And I'm thinking, what are we doing? What is that all about? You get that from God? I wish I could read what he said about being on the tree. I have the quote right here. It's so shocking. It's just embarrassing. It's shocking. It's shameful. I can't even read it. And I know I can read about anything in this community. You know, we're pretty mature in terms of handling this stuff. I can't even do it. Suffice it to say, it is not from the Lord. This whole thing is wrapped up and permeated with lies. Even though it has a certain amount of truth, the lies absolutely ruin it. Let's go on to Easter. Easter fuses the resurrection of Jesus with the rebirth of the pagan fertility gods of sexual perversion and shame. It brings those two together, Jesus and these Greek fertility gods. The main symbol of Easter is the cosmic egg of creation. That's why there are Easter eggs. That's the main symbol, the magical bunny that lays eggs. I'm sorry, bunnies don't lay eggs, but in paganism they do because everything's perverted. Everything is, well, I didn't want to say that. I'll get in trouble. Okay, so the magical bunny that lays eggs represent the great cosmic egg of ancient pagan religions. And the fertility cults are directly tied into the sun cults. We teach our kids to pay homage to these pagan symbols by painting them and hiding them and having them search for them early on Easter morning as the sun rises. Where do we come up with this stuff? Was that out of like Leviticus 23? Is that hidden in the Hebrew? Where did we get this stuff? You have to just like think about it, right? As Christians, we fill parks and face the east and worship on Easter with the rising sun. Where'd we come up with that idea? Let's look at this. Ezekiel 8, 15 through 17. He's just, this angelic being is showing Ezekiel all of the stuff that Israel's doing, all the paganism that crept in and has now captured their hearts. And after showing him a series of stuff that they've allowed, he then goes on and says this. He said to me, do you see the Son of Man? you will still see greater abominations than these. Then he brought me to the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the entrance of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east. And they were prostrating themselves eastward toward the sun. The sages point out that they were actually bowing and worshiping as the sun was rising, facing the sun on purpose as it's rising, worshiping, tying that into the worship of the Lord God. It's a mixture. Do you see the Son of Man? Is it too light of thing? Remember what he said in Jeremiah? Because she thought her harlotry was a light thing, that it was no big deal. And he's saying, and what they're doing here, they're saying it's no big deal. He's saying, really? You think this is no big deal? It's a light thing? Yet, it's the kids, it's for the children, you know. Santa Claus isn't that bad of a guy, you know. So what about the furry little bunny? You know, what's the big deal? Yeah, we say it's not that big a deal. That's what we say. That's how we justify it. It's not a big deal. Worship is worship. Yeah. Is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they have committed here? They have filled the land with violence and provoked me repeatedly. Let me go on. I'm running out of time. Let's go to the first Easter slide. This is the pre-Easter service in D.C. What's in the background? Stone monument tied into the Egyptian forms of paganism that worship the sun. We have the stone monument in the back. That's where everyone's going to face as they worship Christ on Easter morning. Let's go to the next slide. There we are. You got the obelisk, you got the sun rising, facing these, worshiping the Messiah. How is that fundamentally different than what Israel was doing in their day? Pray tell me. Keep in mind that Sunday, the weekly day of worship, is also tied into the day of the sun. It's actually the weekly commemoration of the syncretized Easter festival. It's the weekly commemoration to the annual Easter festival. Finally, I'm just, see if I can close with this. I'm in enough trouble, right? Let's go for it. Okay, the traditional sacred meal at Christmas and Easter should clue us in to the pagan syncretism. What is the choice of meat for these two celebrations? The pig, yes. The pig. Now, stay with me. I'm not judging anyone for it. Hey, what are you doing? We're not there yet. We're not there yet. I know you're hungry. This is the popular choice of meat. It's the Christmas ham. It's also called the Easter ham. And this is problematic. I'm not judging anyone. I'm talking about how we come out of this stuff. We're called to come out of this stuff. See, this is problematic. If this is the main choice of meat for the sacred meal of that sacred festival, it's problematic because of God's dietary laws that he gave to those whom he saved. Animals like the pig and the rat are forbidden for us to eat. The pagan nations, they call them delicacies. God says they're nasty. It's a trick. Don't eat it. It's nasty. He uses terms like abomination and abhorrent in describing these animals as food. Nasty conveys some of the meaning of these Hebrew words. God tells his children they are forbidden to eat them because they are nasty foods. Okay, we can go with the slide. So there is the pig in all of his glory being readied to be eaten. Let's go to the next slide. What do we have here? Those are rats. That's called a rat on a stick. That's a rat on a stick. Now, the reason I bring this up is God says, don't eat these things. The pagans do, but you're not supposed to. And some of us were pagans. We were all at one time pagans. Looking at me like, I know how much you ate. I did too. But after I got saved and realized that God had a plan for our diets, I gave all that stuff up. See, this is a problem for us because, listen, This is Isaiah 66 and verse 17 talking about the end of the age. The context of the end of the age. God says, those who dedicate and purify themselves to enter the groves, following their leader. This is a snapshot of the paganism that's involved at the end of the age as well. And it says, eating meat from pigs, vermin, and rats will perish together. This is the Lord's declaration. Now, he's focused on the paganism. He's condemning the paganism, but he's saying, you know, related to the paganism, if you'll note, is what they eat. They have a diet too. They got it from their gods. God gives a diet to his people. Are you not grafted into Israel? Are you not saved by the same God of Israel? Don't you think that he has a plan for our lives as well and a diet for us? Okay, here's another one. Halloween. Do I need to say anything? I don't have time, but I don't need to say anything anyway. Let me go to my conclusion and application. How do we escape the snare of the widespread and popular syncretisms? You shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Spend time in God's word. God says, come out of her, my people. Come out of her. Walk in my ways. Be different. Be set apart. I'm going to judge her for what she's done. Worship is about the Creator. It's not just worshiping him. It's how we worship him. What about the lost? What about the lost? Leave them alone. You're not called to judge the world. Don't judge the world, what they eat, who they worship, how they worship. It's not your job to point anything. Leave them alone. In 1 Corinthians, Paul says, we don't judge those outside in the world. That's not our job. We judge those in the body of Messiah. We need to love and accept people where they're at and look for opportunities to share the truth. Love, love, love. What about the saved? I say start with yourself. Set high standards for yourself. Come out of this stuff yourself. Rededicate yourself to the Lord every year at Hanukkah and just walk more and more in his ways. No compromise in your life and your domain. Be a Maccabee. Family and friends, do not judge them. Don't require of them to embrace your standards, which you've learned. That's not your job to go over to your brother and say, hey, walk in my light. Here's my light over here. You need to walk in my light. No, leave him alone. The Lord is his Lord, right? Let him figure that out. Do not judge him. Do not give him a hard time. Look for opportunities to share the truth with them. Now, here's where we get savvy. We're to be as wise as serpents and gentle as doves. Be wise like a serpent, gentle as a dove. This is how we're going to do it. Getting better and better at this every year. Okay? Schedule yourself and those under your authority every year on December 24th and December 25th. And then also black out Easter and schedule yourself for that day, for you and your family. And do the same on Halloween. And then when you're invited by your family and friends and fellow Christians to celebrate these pagan mixtures, you can just tell them, look, sorry, thanks for the invitation. I'm already scheduled. I'm booked up. Maybe next year. Wise as a serpent, gentle as a dove. You don't need to point anything out. You just need to say, oh gosh, I'm already booked. Thanks for the invite. You can go over before or after in that week or the following 2 weeks after that, right? Tell your family when it comes to dietary issues. Tell your family and friends. You're going to love this. You're not going to say, what? I can't eat that. That's an abomination to the Lord. Don't do that. You don't need to do that. It's not necessary, okay? Be gentle as a dove. Tell your family and friends that your physician. We learned from Moses that God is our healer. He is our great physician, right? Just tell your family and friends, look, my physician has placed me on this restricted diet due to health issues. And then print them out a list of foods that you can eat. Yeah, get it out to your family and friends. Everyone's being sensitive to everyone's health issues nowadays. So what I'm going to do is I'll create the document. You can just download it and print it out. It'll just say health issues related to diet from your physician. And then I'll have all those listed out, what you can and cannot eat. And then thank them for being sensitive to your physician's diet. And then always remember that Hanukkah is about Jesus, the light of the world, and his glorious ways. In him, we have revelatory knowledge and truth. It always leads to liberty. And true liberty is always manifested in the desire and power to live in harmony with the holy law of our King. Rededicate yourself to him and rededicate yourself to his holy law. And then enjoy what the Bible calls the beauty of holiness. It's a beautiful thing. From the diet to the appointed times to the symbols, all occasions to celebrate some aspect of who Jesus is. It's amazing. Be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. Shabbat shalom.
Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron and his sons saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And we add, in the name of Yeshua our Messiah, the Prince of Peace, so you shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. Yivarech Adonai ve'ishmerecha. Yaher Adonai panavalecha ve'ihunecha. Isa Adonai panavalecha. Ve'asemlecha shalom. Shabbat shalom.
You've been listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. We hope you have found this teaching relevant and challenging for your life. If you are in the Metro Denver area, please join us on Shabbat. Service starts at 1 p.m. and ends at 3 p.m. Kehila Tenuva is located at 8891 Pose Boulevard in Thornton, Colorado, just a few miles north of downtown Denver. For more information, please visit www.graftedin.com. That's www.graftedin.com. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 29993, Thornton, Colorado, 80229. For inquiries, please call 303-761-9948 or email info@graftedin.com. Thank you for listening to the Shabbat message. Shabbat shalom and Shavua tov. Shabbat.